All right, ladies and gentlemen, this is Diana Rivera here with the Co-Creator Series, and today we've got an amazing interview with the people of the days of yore, and I'm going to introduce you guys to the show in just a moment. For those who are listening in for the first time and you've heard about the series, the Co-Creator Series, this audio series, really, we interview lots of really great people, and our whole deal is we're all about empowering and action, the consciousness, passion, and imagination of the creative professional. So when we get great people like the days of yore on the line and we're able to talk about a couple things that we think are very important, which are the skills, strategies, and synergies that get creativity into productivity. So my name is Diana Rivera. You can look me up online at the Co-Creator Series, which is httpccseries.net. You can learn more about me, too, as a coach, consultant, and teacher, writer as well, at creativeempowermentcoaching.com. If you have any questions at all about this program, Days of Yours, please email me at creativeempowerment@gmail.com. And I'll say that once more. It's creativeempowerment@gmail.com. Okay, so let me introduce the Days of Yore. So the Days of Yore is an online site with interviews from artists about the years before fame, money, and roadmaps to their own success. And in the process, as you're reading the material, you definitely, as a reader, get inspired to find your own. They've interviewed a ton of artists, and some of the most well-viewed ones I noticed today on your website were Jennifer Egan, James Franco, George Saunders, Stephen Elliott, Tom McCarthy, just to name a few. They're coming from a whole variety of backgrounds, actually, from visual arts to writers in the performing arts, fiction, you name it, screenwriters. It's very exciting, actually, the content. If you are listening to this and you're like, oh, I want to look this up, well, you should. You should go to www.daysofyore.com. That is the URL. Is that true, Astrid?
The Days of Yore.
There you go. Excellent. Thank you, because I'm not looking at that URL right now, unfortunately. But we've got two of the creators of the Days of Yore with us. We've got Astrid von Arben Ollander.
You said that right. Very impressive.
Oh, gosh,
it's a long name.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, you just know. I'm like, I'm looking at the name. Yeah, looking at the name, like this could be something I found.
You did it, yeah.
Oh, thank you. Well, Astrid is a writer and translator from Stockholm, Sweden. Her work has appeared in the Huffington Post, Shareable.net, The Rumpus, and in the recent ebook Share or Die: Youth in Recession. That's interesting.
Okay.
Her most recent translation work is the Swedish bestseller Easy Money by Jens Lapidus. I hope I pronounced that correctly, too,
mm-hmm.
which will be published by Pantheon in November 2011. That's awesome.
Yes.
Yeah, that's great. I'd love to hear more about that, too, if we have a little chance on this interview.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second person who will be coming on the line, so if you hear another voice and it's a male, well, you know why. It's Lucas Kavner. And Lucas, another Days of Yore, I would say, writer and founder, and we'll learn more about their partnership together. There's actually a third player in the Days of Yore. He is a writer and actor living in Brooklyn, right on. He has performed theater and comedy all over the country, and his work has appeared in the New York Times, MSNBC, Salon, NPR, and The Times, and I'm sure in a lot of other venues. He currently writes for the Huffington Post. Well, this is a great beginning. I love it. And there's a third member, too. You know, Astrid, would you mind telling listeners about the third member to your party?
Absolutely. Evan Dumichel is our third member, who is the director of web strategy, basically, and the genius who's built our site and made it as good as it is, I'd say, purely on a sort of navigational and technical level. He's been huge to help us out. And he's actually an actor himself and lives out in L.A., where you are,
nice.
And is working on a lot of different projects. I don't have his most recent ones on the top of my head right now, but
mm-hmm.
he's a very talented actor, and so he's representing the performance arts on our end as well.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's interesting because, as Astrid knows this, I tend to send questions to my interviewees beforehand just to make sure that we're on some kind of roadmap. But I'm curious to know, you know, I guess right off the bat, how did the three of you come together as collaborators?
Okay, well, it's actually the three of us went to college together many moons ago. Well, not so many moons, but a couple.
Sorry, can you guys hear me? Did I come in okay?
Hey, Lucas. Yes, you did.
Hi, there you are. Fun. Hey, Lucas.
Sorry.
We're live and going.
Here.
So I'm actually just telling Diana about how the idea for the Days of Yore started, but also how Evan, you, and I came together on the project. And I was just going to say that it started the way I think most projects tend to start. If I recall correctly, Lucas and I were walking a street of Williamsburg, Brooklyn one night, and Lucas turned to me actually and said, you know, I have this thought about talking to artists about the time when they were like us, like when they're struggling like we are right now. And I said, you know, that's awesome. We should totally do that. Mm-hmm. And the next day, I think, actually, Lucas sent me an email, and, you know, it was a late night, Brooklyn night, and maybe he didn't think I was for real, but I tend to be. And he emailed me and said, you know, what do you think? Should we do this thing? And it started there, actually. Mm-hmm. And we began on a sort of modest Tumblr platform, doing this on a small scale. And then Evan came into the picture because we felt we wanted to expand and have basically a better platform for the site and to have it not be hosted somewhere else, but to do it ourselves. And Evan came on and he totally built the architecture of the site the way it looks today, which is really wonderful, and we're so pleased with it. And he's done all of that work for us. So he came on a few months later and has since then been an integral part of the team. So that's how it started.
Wow, that's wonderful. That is wonderful. And I'm always curious about creative collaborations, so I might actually ask another layered question to that, probably in a few. But for those who are listening in that just want to learn more about, you know, more other aspects about the Days of Yore and particularly about you guys as creative professionals, I will begin with this question. So tell me about your individual backgrounds in the arts, in your creative profession. And Lucas, since you just came on the line, it'd be great to hear from you first, and then we'll get to hear from Astrid.
Did you want to hear from Astrid first, or me first?
Why don't we hear from you,
oh,
Lucas?
Oh, great, just, perfect.
I love it.
Yeah, I guess this whole thing kind of started, I think, in a way because I was doing so many different things in New York in terms of the arts, and I guess I've, you know, since I kind of got to the city, I've kind of jumped into both like performance, writing, and music, and kind of, you know, doing all sorts of things. You know, even high school, I was still like playing in a band and, you know, doing improv comedy and then doing plays and like making films with friends, and then I've kind of still do that, even, you know, professionally now, just kind of jumping into a lot of different things. So, you know, today, you know, every week I perform, you know, two or three times at the People's Improv Theater in New York, which is a, you know, 100-seat performance venue in New York, which is a great comedy theater. And then I'll be, you know, I write for the Huffington Post during the day for their culture team, and then I'm, you know, in a band still that plays, you know, a couple times a month. And I just wrote a play that was up off Broadway. And so I've kind of just been balancing all these things artistically, and definitely pays really well all the time. Very fruitful. But it's, you know, I think that's part of the appeal of the site, is that a lot of these people that we've found, you know, either were doing tons of different things for a while and kind of siphoned it off into one, or I was interested in people who knew exactly what they wanted right away. It was like, I always have wanted to be a writer. I've always wanted to be a performer, you know, because that's just the opposite of me, kind of, and the things I've done in my life so far.
That's interesting. So as an artist, you are a performer, you're a writer, you're a musician, and you're just a curious person too.
Yeah. I think that's exactly how I describe myself, and sometimes to a fault, I'd say, just that I can't really, you know, as something else will catch my eye or catch my attention, I'll kind of jump on that for a while, and then, you know, I just kind of jump from project to project. On a, you know, if something really appeals to me or interests me, I've been doing that in a sense.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I think we're going to, what you just explained right now in terms of the jumping or the inspiration will actually make its way in other aspects of the conversation as it does, right? Because artists are constantly inspired. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great. I like that. How about you, Astrid? Tell us what you're
about. Well, so actually, it's funny when I mentioned that Lucas and Evan and I went to college together, and actually in college, we all three of us collaborated or in certain different parallel universes in the film world and theater world at college. And so I actually did some film, was my big interest then, but also writing. And from college, I moved on to work with more sort of political and social writing. And in that capacity, I later went in to do an MFA, which I'm just completing from Columbia University, and I'm doing nonfiction writing. And I'm doing now more personal essay work. And that's the kind of writing that I work with now. So as opposed to Lucas, who described himself as a, you know, sort of jack of all trades in the arts world, which I think I would say is very true. I mean, he's in a lot of different worlds. I am primarily rooted in sort of the writing world. That's where I stay. And as you mentioned before, I'm now translating as well, which has become a new interest of mine in the past year or so. And I'm translating novels from Swedish, which is my native language, to English.
That's wonderful. What a great, I love hearing how in both of your stories you're creating these bridges between, you know, maybe formally what you were involved in and how those skill sets that you learned in those, let's say, those domains. Like, say, if it was in film, there's a lot of skill sets you learn, and some of those that are transferable to other areas. It's beautiful to see that happen.
Mm-hmm.
It's just
beautiful.
Well,
actually, the film work I was doing in college was all essay films, and the kind of writing that I do now is personal essay. So there's definitely the same kind of preoccupations and obsessions that I think we also see in the interviews that we do with artists, that the same proclivities and obsessions and possessions tend to resurface no matter what interests people are jumping between. So I think
Astrid's final film in college was incredible, and it was kind of based on something that I think, you know, it was about her family and using kind of all this old footage of her family that she'd put together in this really kind of incredible way. And I thought it really brought together like a lot of her interests now that she's been kind of encapsulated by this film. That was really, really great.
Oh, thank you, Lucas. But yeah, I'd say obsession,
yeah,
you know. the same obsessions of that occupy us thematically, right?
Well,
even
absolutely.
If you're working in lots of different fields, I think you probably also have.
You know, I certainly do. I mean, you know, my background as well, and the past, I mean, I would say a lot of my artistry derives from theater arts as a performer, a writer, director, producer, and then has really taken off from that and has gone to a lot of other places in terms of facilitation and not just seeing arts within the specific art areas, but really seeing creative process and, you know, specializing in that level of work, not only in the ensembles that I create, but more of even my academic work in psychology or with the clients that I work with, or even on this interview series, really. I mean, it's a lot about creative process, perspective, the things we create, how we do it. And what's so cool, actually, is listening, you know, like when you, Lucas, are talking about Astrid, and Astrid, when you're talking about Lucas, it's also fun to hear friends talk about each other, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, I think, when, you know, part of what we wanted to do when we created the project, Days of Yore, was to get an insight or to sort of create, not an artificial way, but to create a way in which we could listen in on other conversations or create conversations and give the possibility for our audience to listen in on those conversations with artists who are not like us now struggling, but who are in a position where I can look back and have that kind of fulfillment and success and to see where their bridges were in their creative process and how important different elements of their development were to them. So, you know, that's really the foundation, I think, for why we wanted to create the site, was to have those conversations and to share those conversations.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I'm looking at the next question that I wanted to ask you, which was exactly that. The question is, why is Days of Yours vital to the artist communities that you serve or your audience? And actually, I'll take that question still, but I'll maybe you know, change it just a little bit. Mm-hmm. Let's say, for example, I was somebody that, you know, wanted to, you know, buy your site, essentially. You know, I love the content. I think it's great and whatever. They wanted to do that, and they wanted to talk to both of you, and they were wondering, well, what's the one key thing that makes it so vital?
Well, I think, actually, Lucas, you're going to probably have a different answer here, but I'll give my first two cents, and that is that I think that there's an idea that everyone has abstractly that people struggled once, you know. Mm-hmm. But it's very different to hear the specifics of that struggle. And there's something very empowering and comforting and ultimately inspiring about hearing those very minute details that may seem completely banal at first glance. You know, what meaningless jobs did your favorite writer once have? And how long did they, you know, wait tables? And what kind of terrible apartments did they live in? I mean, I think that the thing that we're able, the niche that we're able to provide, and what I think is important, is that we give that look of super candid specifics to what is otherwise, I think, brushed over as sort of abstract generalizations of how artists once had it rough or something. I mean, we say, okay, how and what did you do and how did you build your artistic sort of path in a very specific way? And that's sort of our niche, I think. But
I very much agree with that. I think the original idea was like in other interviews and even in like longer form interviews, I feel like that portion of their lives where it's like, oh, I had like a, you know, they'll tell a story about a crappy job they had, and then all of a sudden they're, you know, writing a Pulitzer Prize winning novel, and you're like, okay, well, there's a huge
time between
that,
right.
Where this bridge between, you know, you working a dead-end job where you were, like, miserable and then writing this book and becoming a huge sensation, I mean, even that period between then was what was interesting to me,
right.
And I felt like wasn't being covered really. And
mm-hmm.
there's, you know, some comments when I post, you know, we recently, you know, took a little bit of a break of interviews and then came back. And I remember a friend posted a comment when I reposted the link that was like, oh, good, now I won't be depressed anymore. It was a tough month. And it was like a friend who just, you know, had gotten used to reading them every week and the comfort in that, because it is, I mean, everyone without fail that we've talked to, I think, has, even if some had it a little bit easier than others, everyone struggled, everyone, in some capacity. I mean, and so I think that is extremely comforting to see and see how, you know, and see the detail with which they struggled, too.
I think it sort of turns around and makes, you know, the young people who are in their, not in their yours, but in their present tense, so to speak, now, to see some sort of meaning in the potentially, you know, chaotic nature of their own struggling lives now. It's sort of like, okay, these things will add up, and there's something very comforting in that.
Yeah,
I think, though, just
yeah.
to add one other thing that I think that the site does and that I really am sort of proud of is that, you know, we talk a lot about the bombardment of information in today's media-saturated world. And, you know, I think that we all are claimed to have short attention spans, and interviews and articles get shorter and shorter. They're being broken down to basically, you know, the length of a tweet, say.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's kind of wonderful that we can have this space where conversations are allowed to be real, which means that they are at times more rambling, that they are really rich in their length. And you could argue that they're too long sometimes, but I think that's actually the beauty of what we're able to offer, that they are as uncut as they are. And I think what that does is that it gives our readers a real feel for the artists that we speak with in a way that is pretty special and maybe even a little bit unique. You know, you get their a look and a feel for their tonalities of speech and of their personalities and their proclivities. And I think that that is hard to get today in really most forms because they're just so truncated somehow.
Mm-hmm. Do you guys think that, I mean, when one has really experienced their own struggles and have come to terms with it, because struggles mean so many different things to so many people, but let's just say for the most part, we understand it, given that, you know, we don't have all that much time to talk about what struggles are. But so the general struggles, right?
Yeah.
Once you really come head to head with it, that it makes your success that much sweeter.
Mm-hmm. I think that's true. I think that there's a quote, Julia Alvarez, the writer. She was her success came rather late to her. She had been writing for nearly 20 years by the time she published How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accent, which is now basically required reading in many high schools, you know. And she said that for her, the fact that success came so late was in a way that she had, as you know, to use the word struggled for a long time. She knew that writing was something that was like a practice to her, that she needed to do, that was something she could not live without, because otherwise she wouldn't have done it and had it be so hard for that long. You know, it's a little bit different if you have your bestseller at 25 and then you sort of need to write your next one and on you go. And so she was saying that to her, therefore, success, it wasn't just that it was sweeter, but it was also that in some ways it was less important, in that she had really understood that what was most important was the craft for her, because she had been willing to do it for so long without the rewards of success.
Yeah, I've been really interested. A lot of the interviews kind of touch on that in a way of like, what you know, how you earn it, and like how, you know, everybody for the most part has said like persistence, and how, you know, it's the hardest part is sitting down to write.
Yeah.
You know, sitting down every day, that's the hardest thing. And you know, some people I would say seem to figure out much earlier on that like they had to do it. There's like no other way. There's no backup plan. You know, there's a classic thing for actors where it's like, if you have a backup plan, you can't be an actor. Mm-hmm. And I think to some extent that's, in a way it's true, I guess, of art. I don't know if it's just for acting, but, you know, then you get somebody like George Saunders, who's, you know, one of my favorite writers ever, and he had such a roundabout way. You know, he always loved to write, but he was, you know, he went to a school of mines and was an engineer for years and years, and like worked overseas as an engineer, and didn't even know master's programs existed in writing until he was like a lot older. Mm-hmm. And then stumbled across the idea of a master's program in the arts, and then just suddenly was like, oh, I would like to do that, and then got involved. And now, of course, it's like a wonderful and MacArthur genius and all this stuff. But his, you know, to him, it kind of just came as part of a natural path of his life. And then to other people, it was like they knew so early on that there was nothing else they could possibly do with their life. And I think that's an interesting balance, too, we've kind of seen a lot of.
Yeah, and you see sort of two sides, like you're pointing out there. I think that there's definitely the people that are sort of hardliners, I'd say. You know, the photographer Thomas Roma, who when I tried to speak to him about sort of, well, how does one support oneself or something, he just said, one doesn't need to support oneself. You know, our standards are too high. You can be an artist and live on nothing. You can still take your photos. He was very hardline in the sense that if you want this, you can do this. It's more an issue of the comforts that we set up for ourselves and the expectations that we might have. And then we have, you know, others like Anne Fadiman, and I think also George Saunders, both writers who did say that, you know, when you had kids in a family, maybe it was nice that they had normal jobs, and maybe it's too much to demand that in today's world where it's so hard to make a living as an artist that one do only that. I mean, so there's definitely two sides to that argument, sort of the give all or the sort of, well, maybe it's okay not to, you know, and is it possible to make it if you don't give the hard line? I mean, we have examples of both, I guess you could say.
Yeah, you know, I just wanted to throw in, because all these examples are so colorful, just how vastly different each individual is. What, you know, their temperament, beliefs, attitudes, interpretations of the world, like what they're willing to deal with. I mean, it's just so vastly different. And
of course.
Yeah, it goes, you know, like you guys had said about kind of, I mean, and I think you guys really propose it when you give your interviewees these questions, making them self-reflect on their past, to really get in touch with, this is really where you came from. Everything that you have now is a result of that.
And sometimes that can be quite difficult. I had someone recently who I was, you know, prepping for an interview, and when we started talking a little bit about the questions, she almost got her guard up and said, "Oh my gosh, this is so hard. I haven't thought about this ever, and it's too hard for me to think about all of this. To think of my former self in this position is too painful now."
Yeah, yeah, the idea like some of you. Oh my God, my 20s. Please God, do not talk
about this. Oh dear.
And then other people. Like a week ago, I interviewed. He was the head writer, and now he's the executive producer of the Colbert Report. And he came from like an improv background, and you know, Second City in Chicago, and all this stuff, and has just the most incredible stories, and just would want so bad to talk about his 20s.
Yeah.
And that was the first time, I think. I mean, Astrid's done a bunch more of the interviews at this point than I have with writers especially. But that was the first time anyone that I'd spoken to was just so like, oh, and this story, and then, oh, man, and then this story about my
cousin. Dying to talk about their 20s.
Yeah, yeah. It seems like everything else, like, oh, and then I, you know, it is a tough time. In retrospect, I mean, people, you know, have fond memories, where it's usually like the struggle is part of the, you know, they can look back now with kind of a lighter view, but at the time it was really, you know, it was a really tough tough time in a lot of ways for a lot of them.
Yeah, really, the big question is, what is up with the 20s? Maybe we'll,
we'll
deal with that
but
in
you
a
know,
moment.
But, you know, to give us all some 20s perspective, the poet Josh Bell, he said, you know, he published a poetry collection that was very well received, and when I asked him about his advice for young writers, and he said, you know, take advantage of your 20s and treasure them, because even though there is the stress of the struggle and whatnot, you know, no one expects anything from you when you are yet unpublished. You have, therefore, every potential. You know, you cannot disappoint, but you also can do anything you want. And as soon as you have that successful first book or first performance or whatever it may be, there is a reference point for who you are as an artist and what is expected of you. And suddenly you must trump yourself or show growth or whatever it is. And so there's something rather magical, too, about this sense of total freedom that where you can stake out your own path.
I think a lot of us, especially, and I know a lot of my friends feel this way as they struggle through their art and artistic career, is that they think someone waiting for them to do something specific. It's like, I have to do it this way, or I have to do things that way, or something. And I think this site has done a really good job of showing, like, you know, no answer.
Oh, you're breaking up, Lisa.
Everyone. Oh, sorry. How about now? Is that better?
You're
okay.
Good. That's great.
Say it again.
I was just saying, people in their friends of mine, I think a big thing is that they feel like they're waiting for something, or that something is just going to come to them, or that there's somebody waiting for them to have a certain path, or there's some unforeseen force that like expects something very specific out of them. And I think what the site has kind of shown is that there is definitely no path to anything. Everybody has had, I mean, there are certainly similarities, but there is no answer to what artistic success is or how to attain it at all in any way, I think. And I think that, you know, for friends of mine, especially, who are trying to make a living out of this, like, that's been a real comfort, too.
I guess the only common thread is the one that you referred to before, Lucas, which is, you know, no matter what, it's perseverance, right?
Yeah.
I think the common thread with all of these artists and writers who've had very different paths is that no matter how much they were racked by self-doubt or no matter how much they wanted to give up and so on, there was that sense of perseverance, ultimately. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, they, you know, kept pushing, even though they felt they'd been pushed too far, and they kept going.
You know, it's interesting. I love that you said that word. It's it's kind of a word concept theme. A couple months ago, I interviewed on the same show John Jacobson of the Artist Toolbox, and he has the show where it's all over PBS. He interviews, you know, well-known artists all around the world, and he's just such a lovely, lovely man, and artist. And that was the key theme that came up multiple times. And, you know, what advice would you give to artists that are, you know, in their, you know, formalizing phase of their career? He's like, perseverance. You've got to persevere. He's just like, that is it. That is the
perseverance.
Word. Perseverance. Yeah, and you know, it's like you guys said, there are so many challenges. And in today's society, I mean, we have to be honest, there is an economic recession. For as much as you want to believe it, not believe it, accept it, deal with it, have, you know, whatever, a personal, you know, relationship with it, but there are elements that are in the air about it, and it makes the work that any artist is going to do, well, it just puts a little extra element of charge. Like,
absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And actually, that's one thing I've got.
Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, no, the one last thing, I'd love to hear, Lucas, what you were going to say. With the interviews that I've read on Days of Yore, that's one of the things I've gotten to, is you just got to keep working at what you do.
Yeah.
You got to be nonstop. Yeah.
I remember interviewing Noah Hawley, who's a TV writer. He created the show The Unusuals and another show called Generation Y that was on ABC last year, and the day I interviewed him, his show had been canceled.
Oh,
And he had just spent like 2 years on it or something. But he was completely unfazed. I mean, like, he was upset, but like, it didn't cause a skip in his step. I mean, he was just, you know, everything. Because he had realized at that point that was all he knew how to do. And I mean, I think that was really, really cool to hear. I mean, he literally, like, he'd been working on this thing for 2 years and it had just gone away. And his other show, the exact same thing had happened. But he was like, I'm going to wake up tomorrow at 5. We still have all these offices. Like, we're still working. I mean, I'm working on 3 other things now and blah, blah, blah. And,
yeah.
You know, it was. And I think everyone, Astra, you're going to test, I think, and I would agree that, like, everyone ends it with just keep going. If this is what you're supposed to do, then this is what you're supposed to do. And mm-hmm. nobody can tell you, take that from you. You know?
Exactly. And I think I have one of my favorite examples of that sort of extreme is speaking with the writer John DeGatta, who I admire immensely as a writer. He explained, you know, he told that when he was in graduate school for writing, his work was so disliked by his classmates that people at times refused to workshop it, you know, in the critique circle. They would. One guy came in and just ate a Burger King burger and sloppily and was like, I'm not even engaging in this because this guy is not a writer. You know, just like really. And it was, he described getting these constant sort of slaps in the face. He was never the it writer, as he called it, you know, in his group. But somehow, despite all that discouragement, he had this sense somewhere that he still wanted to go on, that he saw some sort of value in what he was doing. He felt that he knew a little bit of what he wanted to do. And the writer Gary Steingart said a similar thing. He said, you know, you should go into a critique situation or whatever it is you put your work out there, you should go into that situation ready to reject what is told to you in terms of editorial advice as well. You should be so sure of yourself and some sort of inner assuredness of your conviction of what you do, that you're able to do that. And that's a tall order, I would say.
Huge order.
Yeah.
Oh, fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, I have a couple questions. I'm sort of looking at them right now thinking, I just love how the free form nature of how we're doing this, because what it's becoming so apparent to me is how much information you have both taken from your interviews. And I'm just wondering right off the bat, are you incorporating it into your life?
You know, I think what Lucas said before about his friend who made a comment, you know, oh, thank goodness the site is back, you know, after our summer vacation, I don't have to be depressed. I think there is something I take from doing the interviews and reading them and working with them that sort of it depends on my mood or where I am in my life at the moment, you know, and sometimes pieces of advice stand out and they can become like mantras to me depending on how I'm dealing with something that may go on in my own life, you know. So I think that there's a lot of things that I'm incorporating. I don't know if about direct sort of practical things, I'm not quite sure, but I think some of that John DeGatta gung-ho and you know, some of that perseverance we were talking about, certainly I feel as though I'm standing a little bit straighter having read mm-hmm. a lot of these and worked mm-hmm. with them.
That's interesting.
I would agree. I think it was the same before.
You're breaking up.
Oh, sorry. How about now? Oh,
yeah, perfect, good. Lucas.
All right. It's just like pockets, Maine.
Yeah.
I think it's just about, I think the biggest thing is just realizing that nobody is waiting for you except yourself. And I guess that's a little, you know, cheesy, I suppose. But it's you are dictating your path. And somebody's not going to give you the key and, you know, your friends aren't waiting for you to get a book deal. I mean, it's not, your friends just want you to be happy, and your parents, you know, generally for the most part probably do as well. And it seems like everybody has had such a vastly different experience getting to the point that they're at now that they're, I mean, it's been extremely comforting to me to see that, you know, you do this. It's all what you make of it. It's all what you make of your career and your life and the things you want. And I think that is a pretty golden rule to take from all the interviews, which are vastly different. But that I think is a very overarching thing you can take and feel a lot of comfort in. And you know, all my artist friends have taken, I think, something similar to that.
I think there's one thing that stands with me a lot, and it's from this photographer Thomas Roma's interview. He said, you know, we're in a sort of age of anxiety, right? You know, Generation X and Y are so, and the millennials, whatever we call ourselves, mm-hmm. are so anxiety-ridden about what to do, and sort of what Lucas is saying, you know, will someone hand you a path and all these things? We go to school to try to learn how to be avant-garde or something, which is total mm-hmm. counterintuitive. But, and he said, you know, instead of taking these maps from schools to avoid all the minefields that you might stumble upon, what about if stepping on the mine is part of it? You know, what if that's part of your path? What about if that sudden chaos or is part of it? And I think that was just a wonderful thing to say, and I think I've taken a lot from that. You know, if something doesn't go your way, well, you know what? Something might come of it. It's a way of looking at fate or what have you that is, I think, productive. And instead of despairing, you know, maybe stepping on the mine is part of it, and it'll lead somewhere else.
Well, I mean, you know, it's I love that idea of the fateful aspect to things, because if I think, you know, since I'm not involved in your collaboration with the site, but I look at your site, I'm like, wow, this is an amazing archive of information and real testaments of what artists are dealing with, and that's why I'm drawn so much to the site. And I'm sort of wondering about the fate between all of you guys in the creation of it. So, you know, Lucas had this idea, like, oh, I'd be curious, you know, about the, you know, what people experienced before they were successful, and kind of galvanized your attention and your other friends. And when you guys actually began to do it, this is when fate becomes the actual practice itself. I'm wondering, Were you, you know, as you were, how did you begin it? Were you like kind of stumbling through, like, oh my God, what are we going to do? Like, you know, what was your collective process in it?
Well, it was stumbling at first.
Yes, it was stumbling at first. Right. But I think, you know, the thing is that the site is started on a very simple idea, and it continues on that simple idea. So though we stumbled, certainly, because, you know, how do you get these great people to say yes to you, to do interviews? And that was all rather tricky in the beginning, I'd say. Mm-hmm. But,
yeah.
You know.
And now dealing with publicists. Which we,
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
As we try to retire, it's like, oh yeah, publicist. Oh my God,
yeah,
right,
the
exactly.
Brick wall, you know.
Whole other thing.
So all of those things, but I think that, you know, the simple idea is really very much what still characterizes the site. It still is. I mean, I would say even if we have sort of stumbled around and it's gone in different places, I'd say, don't you think, Lucas, that, you know, the first thought, which was interview, talking to people that we admire, amazing artists about their time before, you know, before writing, before performing, before whatever it was, that's still what it is. It's that simple. We haven't really, we're pretty true to that basic premise, I think.
Yeah. The magic of it is it's bare. I mean, like, we've kept the design of it very bare, I think, too, in that way. It's just like it says what it is. I mean, it's just, this is interviews to, and, you know, about before they were successful, and here's something to inspire you, and we're just going to talk to these people. And, you know, we've definitely talked a lot recently about, you know, the future of it and things like that. But still, I mean, the appeal, I think, has become like, oh, wow, what a cool thing in 10 years to still have this archive. I mean, this
right.
is an archive of artists that are all talking about their path to being artists. And what a great thing to just continue to build that and hopefully, you know, other things come of it for sure, but I think that is still the main appeal, and I think that's what we've stuck with.
Mm-hmm. And how does it, you know, I mean, I love stuff online because I can read it and this, that, and the other, and, you know, as things continue to progress, because they do, you know, it'll be interesting for you all as collaborators to think about that next layer of will it come mm-hmm. off the words from the internet, and will it be in someone's hand, or will it collectively bring people together? What will
right.
that be? Yeah.
Those are all
we certainly talk about book things and things like that. And I've still, like, I mean, I really like the idea of even a podcast in the future, you know, in the future. If, you know,
mm-hmm.
there's just the name of it and the I think it is, it's very simple brand now, and it's such a, you know, it can encapsulate a lot, and also just a very simple thing, which is what it is right now. And I think there's a lot of options, and it's exciting.
I loved it. Astrid, were you going to add something to that?
No, I know that. I think that's great. I think one thought, too, is that, you know, it's sort of a grateful process in the way that when we started and we didn't know where we were going and we sort of fumbled and so on, it was also harder in the way that, you know, how do we get these people to do this?
Mm-hmm.
The wonderful thing is that now that we have 65 interviews on the site,
mm-hmm.
which is a huge amount, mm-hmm. and I don't know how many words are on there, and how many wonderful names, and that can sort of stand on their own. it's a snowball effect, I would say, because now when we approach people, it's even happened that I've approached someone and they have said, oh, I know about that project. I would like to do that. And that's, I think, so enormously gratifying, considering where we were fumbling around just a year ago.
Isn't that great? Isn't that absolutely great? I mean, look at this way. You know, look how much it helps people. And I always, working with clients or, you know, the audience that I serve as a coach, consultant, facilitator and stuff, it's really a lot about your audience or people that you're really serving. I mean, in some cases, you might be helping them.
We'd hope so.
Yeah. Yeah, and you guys are a real clear example of that. You are really helping people. So I want to, for those people that are, you know, kind of are listening in and want to get to some more nuts and bolts, I'm going to ask you guys some sets of questions. And it's more, the way you can answer them is considering the trends, just the biggest trends in the interviews that you've, all 65 of them that you've had, right? Mm-hmm. So for example, the struggles. We talked about that earlier. What are like three typical, or three or five or whatever, just a quick list of the typical struggles that the artists have had?
So do you mean that sort of like larger metaphysical
just
struggles,
the trends,
or like very practical?
Yeah.
There are the metaphysical and the practical struggles. They are both.
Yeah. Well, I think that they go hand in hand, right? I think that one of the main struggles that you see everyone have is the issue of self-doubt. And, mm-hmm. you know, before recognition, how long do you keep going, and do you keep going toiling in obscurity and so on? So, but to give some empowerment to anyone who's listening about that and their own self-doubt, you know, the writer Luc Sant said, self-doubt is what will keep you young. The minute you are self-satisfied, you'll be ready for the glue factory. So, you know, keep it up with the self-doubt.
That's good.
But I think that's a major one, right, Lucas?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I would definitely agree with that for sure. And I think another one, I guess, is you know, money on all sense. I mean, like, I love
very
the Gary Steingart stuff, the Gary Steingart stuff about just get a job where you can sit in an office and shut the door. You know, how key that was for him, because he used his day job to write. And, you know, I'd say, I mean, everybody has their financial struggles, and they're all very different, but I think that is certainly it.
I guess the key you're hitting on there, which is very true of a trend, is that, you know, how do you find the time to do the work that you want to do while you have to do the work that you must do for, you know, very practical supporting yourself reasons. And then that's a major trend of struggle, I'd say. You know, like for the painters, how do you find the time to paint and the money for a studio? For the writers, how do you find the hours, the simple hours to do the writing you have to do? You know, Jennifer Egan, who just won the Pulitzer recently, she was talking about sort of really trying to piece together a way in which she could get solid hours to work. And Carol Maso said that she would, you know, she figured out her system, which was she would work every job she could get her hands on, no matter what it was, for 6 months, and then she would take 6 months completely off and go somewhere and just write. And that was the way for her to make it work. But that is a major hurdle for people. How do you... Because, you know, we're working with creative types and artists, and creating something, it demands hours, you know, and mm-hmm. how do you find them?
Yes. So self-doubt, when do I know I should keep going, and when do I know I should just stop? Mm-hmm. Money and time management.
Yeah.
Interesting trends, right? And all 65 of them, these are the big trends that are seen and understood by people who are now in, you know, good places in their career. That's interesting. Now,
I want to add one more little one is actually understanding the business. I think,
yes, that's
a
big one.
A couple of the actors, you know, all the like the three off Broadway actors especially who are not, you know, full time and don't make an exorbitant amount of money, but fully figured out the business side of things. I mean, that, you know, that mining those things is a big struggle, like knowing how to, you know, self-market yourself and how to promote yourself and things like that. That seems to be something that people slowly figure out how to do and how to make it their own. I think that's a big thing too.
Yeah,
that
is
big.
How to do that when you're limited by funds, when you're limited, you know, with your own self-doubt.
Right.
Right. So it's like it all adds up.
Yeah. Exactly.
Peter Friedman, who's one of my favorite actors in New York, he's just this, he's like who I want to be in 30. He's just like this wonderful man and actor, and he's, you know, he's been in some of the best plays the last few years. He he, you know, even when he was in his 40s, quit for a second. And, like, he didn't work for 3 years, his 40s. He couldn't get any work. And there was this pastry that he, this, like, bakery that he always loved. And he tried to revive this old bakery, like, for 2 years. And was just like, I guess I'm going to revive this bakery now. And it fell through. And then he was like, well, I'm going back to act. You know, it just, this weird hiccup in his life suddenly happened. And you know, he thought he had lost, you know, the love of it and the love of, you know, figuring out the business side of things. He thought he'd finally been expelled. And then he found a whole new life after that, even. And that was in his 40s. And I thought that was a cool little story.
That's a very cool little story. That's
yeah.
Well, there's also, and the other side of that, you know, after figuring out the business, you know, it's sort of, it relates to it, but sort of the artist, the painter, sort of iconic painter Will Cotton put it this way. He said deliberately socializing, you know, putting yourself out there. I mean, the image of the artist is, or the writer is someone who sits in their garret or their studio and works alone. But you have to fight that urge, is I think a trend we've heard, and be willing to put yourself out there, whether it's navigating the actual business or it's, you know, navigating just the social world. You know, who will publish you if they don't know you, unless, you know, and who will cast you if they don't know your face? And so, you know, putting yourself out there. I mean, Will Cotton, what he did actually is he decided to, because he knew nobody in the art world but felt his work was in a mature place, he started throwing these sort of parties and inviting anybody who wanted to come. And through one of those parties, you know, Mary Boone came from the Mary Boone Gallery, and then there you go. That's his gallerist, and then, you know, now he's this very successful artist. So, you know, it's also that ability to get outside yourself. It's a struggle for people, I think, who may not be inclined to be the social butterflies, but to say, I need to put myself out there. I need to meet people. I need to sort of take care of my image, how lame that may sound, you know, but that's mm-hmm. true.
Oh, yes. I have actually so much to say about that one. And there is one little part I might say after I ask you this next question, which is this. The same idea with trends. What are ways, some trending ways, that these artists have overcome these kinds of challenges?
Well, let's think about that for a second. I think in the Will Cotton example, you know, he was not so comfortable with the social setting, and so he forced himself, and then he became comfortable. So it's kind of that cliche, perhaps, way of saying you face your fears and then you overcome them. And I think similarly, perhaps, with writers who don't dare put their work out there to show it to somebody, to send it out. I mean, Jennifer Egan describes how she was always sending material out. Even if she was getting rejection letters, she had to get over that fear and just send things right back out. And that's, I think, a big one, just sort of facing it head on and saying, you can still do this.
Yeah.
I also think getting older. I mean, I think a lot of these people, like, didn't, you know, they talk about how they didn't really know who they were yet for so long.
Yeah.
And when they were throwing so many things at the wall, and just hoping things stuck. And then as you get older, I mean, you just, it becomes every little problem and every little thing starts, you know, becoming less of a, you know, huge world-shaking phenomenon that they don't know how to deal with. And I think it just comes with time. And a lot of them, especially, like, as they were struggling financially and all this stuff, as they get older, they actually started to realize more because they had stuck with it this long that this is what they were doing. And so the more they come to terms with that, the less, you know, earth-shattering these smaller, you know, struggles became, and they can now look back on it and have perspective. I think that's a big one too.
Yeah, this week's interview, Sean Ryan is the creator of the successful TV show The Shield, among others. He said, you know, that he felt that time was so important to him because looking back, he realized that the work he was doing needed time. Like, it needed his personal maturity and his life experience. He needed the struggle part to actually produce the work that would make his success.
Yeah, he needed to meet the people that he was going to write about.
Exactly,
you know?
Exactly.
To get older and meet and have understanding and get out of himself as much as he could so that he could write about interesting people.
And I think just a very practical, sort of more toolboxy kind of thing that people can do, and I think is a trend that you see, is sort of relates to what Lucas was saying before, the Gary Steingart recommendation of getting a job where you can close the door around you and perhaps do some of the work you wanted to do also. I think a lot of the artists we have spoken to have realized that they need to find jobs, because pretty much all of them had to have other kinds of work to support themselves for a long time, to find jobs that allowed them to still do the work. So that depends on who you are personally. You know, maybe being a waiter helps you because it's not something you have to it's not using the same skill sets as writing, if you're a writer, say. But others couldn't do it because they were so exhausted when they get home. You know, you have to figure out what it is that you can do, and that still leaves that energy for you to go home and do that thing you want to do. But I think that's a big one, too, like figuring out what will work for you and prioritizing and sort of taking control of your own life enough to say, I have to say no to that project or that job or whatever because I have to do this one, and this is how I can get my own work done.
That's right. And, you know, and all to persevere.
Yes, exactly. All to persevere.
All to persevere. And it's interesting when we talk about, you know, age. Well, a lot of these artists, in terms of the trend, they were getting older. And maybe with some of that age is also a greater, it's almost the force of someone's creative passion can become more sharp in a way. You know, I mean, who knows universally the energies that we work in, but that energy could become laser sharp. I don't know if this is making any sense, but I sometimes see things in terms of that. It's, and I mean, I experienced that in even my own life, in my own 20s, for example. I mean, I was involved in a lot of amazing art projects. Amazing, of course, you know, it's like these ensemble creations and this, that, and the other. And then over the years, now, you know, I'm in my 30s, for example, and I feel energy even around the creative stuff I do, and I feel that it's getting sharper in a way. And I don't know what it is. Maybe it's my age. Maybe it's the compounded experiences, the struggles, the success, more struggles, you know, the way the universal energies work. But
somehow I think age gives you gravity, though, you know, that you now perhaps are able to defend what you want more and to stand by what you do better
because
you have a sense of yourself. Like what Lucas was saying before, you know, you don't really know completely who you are yet when you're too young. And that's, then it's hard to assert yourself.
That's right. Yeah, you know, one thing that I've been really into lately, talking to, you know, clients or whatever about just friends, really, is that whatever it is, your fear, you've ultimately got to love what you do more than you love your fear. You just got to love it more. 100%.
And I think that's another thing to remember and through the struggle is that, you know, okay, you might be struggling, but you get to do what you love. How many people in the world are doing things they could care less about, you know?
Right.
So it's an issue of priority.
And then why they loved it a lot sometimes. And there were some days where they were, you know, they were sitting at their desk and they don't want to do it. And they're like,
of course.
But I have to.
Yeah, do I really have to?
Yeah, do I have to? Exactly. I mean, you know, routine with it. I mean, even as you...
Oh, I lost you, I think.
Lucas, we somehow lost you in the little...
Are you still there?
Oh, yeah, still there. Sorry.
No problem. We got your voice.
So
I'm looking at the time, just conscious of the fact we only have about 8 more minutes. And just really quickly, I want to hear from both of you. For those listeners that are like, I want to start checking out the Days of Yore. So obviously people go to www.thedaysofyore.com. I'm curious, out of all the artists that you've interviewed, you probably have many that you relate to. But is there one for each of you that, for whatever it was, is just this kind of sticking? And who is it? So we can read it.
Oh, what a hard question. Lucas, do you have one on the top of your head?
I would say George Saunders for me. He was just the one. He's my favorite writer, I think. And I love his stuff. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but I am. I just love his style, and I've loved him for so long, and I was so nervous to interview him, and then he was just so utterly comfortable with himself and what he's done, and he had such a strange life and such a strange path. You know, I was talking about him earlier, you know, he went to the Colorado School of Mines, and he, you know, was an engineer for years, and then he worked on an oil rig, like, overseas, and he was, you know, swimming in the water next to the oil rig, and just suddenly was like, what am I doing? And then came back to the States and was at a friend's party somewhere in the mountains and saw an article in a magazine about, you know, somebody who went to a grad school program and was like, I could do that. And he had a family at this point, you know, he had a kid and a wife, and how it was just, you know, he found his path through such such strange circumstances, and I think a lot of them are really great when you know, people who knew the whole time and knew exactly what they wanted the whole time. And I think he was such an interesting example of somebody who his life experience and his roundabout path kind of gave him this kooky look at the world and kind of gave him his perspective. Mm-hmm. And I think that was really fascinating for me. And he was just so, as a human being, he was so confident and comfortable and secure with himself because he'd gone through all that stuff and because he was so confused and because he kind of just did these strange things to get to where he was. And mm-hmm. and yeah, he sticks with me a lot, quite a bit.
That's great. I'm gonna check that one out for sure. I haven't read that one yet. Excuse me, but
yeah.
Astrid, how about yours?
I think it's a hard question, but I think for different reasons, different ones stick out. But I think sort of going off a little bit with Lucas said in terms of my favorite might be because it's one of my favorite interviews to have done, and I think that probably relates to what Lucas was saying with his too. Is, you know, Jennifer Egan, who just won the Pulitzer and who's one of the most sort of remarkable writers working in the English language today, she struck me as the most warm and generous and honest person I had spoken with in this context. And she, I love her interview because she dared to really tell it somehow in its darkest moments, talking about her panic attacks in her 20s and her deepest moments of fear about what she was doing and admitting to failure, really. And you know, she worked on a book for over a year, her first book that never was published, and that she just showed to friends and realized that it was utterly a failure and utterly just going in the trash. And the way that she talks about sort of different moments of insight in her life as a writer, you know, even before she was what people would call a quote-unquote writer, before she was even published at all, you know, how she was dealing with the sense of failure, but also the sense of desire and perseverance. And she's just very real in her interview, I'd say. She really takes us into the nitty-gritty details in a way that is really, truly wonderful. So I would recommend that one.
I think Jennifer Egan is the perfect starting point if you're just checking out the site for the first time. I mean, she, mm-hmm. that interview is just so chock full of everything I think we're talking about here, and
yeah.
she does it with such grace
and warmth.
You know, she's so eloquent about her own life, and yeah, and so mm-hmm. so open and kind and great, and it's a really great interview, that one.
And then I would just add, you know, I don't identify with this one as much, but I find it to be one of the most remarkable ones, and one of the most remarkable people, which is that the one I mentioned before, the Thomas Roma, the photographer, which comes up again and again as an interview that many people that speak to me about the site love and it affected them somehow, because he is so completely unapologetic and has no patience for anyone with any buts, so to speak, about there. He doesn't have any patience for the self-doubt, let's put it that way, or patience for concerns about, you know, living conditions or whatever. He's just so strong, and he did it from the very beginning. He was completely unrelenting, and I think he's really kind of a sage, actually, and also incredibly articulate. So what he's, I think it's a great interview to read because it sort of shakes you up a little.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. So we're talking about George Saunders, Jennifer Egan, and then the last one was?
Thomas Roma.
Great. All right, so there's a lot here I'm going to be processing, I think, even after this interview, I can tell you that. So I want to, even though we have 2 more minutes, I want to hear just very quickly, because I like to ask this question when I can, and you're going to answer it with only one word, maybe 2, possibly 3, but no more than that, okay? I like to ask the interviewees what creativity means to them. So I want to ask the same to you. What does creativity mean to you? And you have 1, 2, or 3 words to use.
All right. Do you have one, Lucas, or do you want me to go? I'm thinking.
No, I don't. You'll have to. Whoever gets it first can go.
I don't have a one word, but I'll give you a one word or 2 word, but then can I give you a longer one afterwards?
It's all maybe.
Maybe. Okay, fine. I'll wing it here and say 3 words. I'd say desire, ability, discipline.
That's great. That's great.
Yeah. And I would say combining dream and understanding. That's four.
That's great.
I think.
Ooh, people.
You get away. You get away with four.
I'll let that one go.
Right. The and is an ampersand, so it's just a symbol.
That was an ampersand.
That's
I love
right.
it.
That's right. Doesn't count. Doesn't count. I know that you have to go, but I want to just say I was once listened to a panel with the Nobel laureates on what does creativity mean, and what they were saying was that people like to think that creativity is all, you know, the eureka moment, but the truth is that it's 99% blood, sweat, and tears, and it's 1% inspiration.
There you go. I 100% agree with that. I want to thank you guys both for just talking with me today and for the people that are going to be listening.